Hello, everyone. Dan Delman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. In today's program, we're going to have a modest lesson in grammar. It's taken from the Christian Science Monitor Weekly of July 30th in a column by Melissa Moore. And she says, "Recently I wrote a four-sentence email that contained 3 exclamation points. It was so hot last week. 1. Have a great time on your trip. 2. See you soon. 3. This goes against the rules I learned in school. Like most students in the past 100 years, I was taught to employ these marks rarely. Because, as Fowler's Dictionary of Modern Usage puts it, overuse of exclamation marks in expository prose is a sure sign of an unpracticed writer, or of one who wants to add a spurious dash of sensation to something that is unsensational. Now, though, we are in a period of exclamation inflation, and I have succumbed. In certain contexts today, it is quite normal to use exclamation marks where once we used periods. And if we have something we really want to emphasize, we need 2 or 3 or 5. Like monetary inflation, exclamation inflation goes through cycles. And the last time this form of punctuation offered so little bang for the buck was during the Victorian era. Victorian writers loaded informal personal letters and novels with a bounty of exclamation marks. In his wonderful Making a Point, the Persnickety Story of English Punctuation, David Crystal quotes an 1841 parody of the popular cheap novels of the day, in which a character reacts to news that his love, Claire, is marrying a man named Jacob Snooks. He says, "Can't be. No go. Stump up to church. Too true. Claire just made Mrs. Snooks. Madness. Double exclamation point. Rage. Double exclamation point. Death. Triple exclamation point." Critical reaction to this sort of prose led to the strictures against exclamation points that governed our writing for most of the 20th century. Today, we mostly use exclamation marks in informal contexts, such as on social media. Our punctuation changes when we text, in particular. Periods are not necessary, since hitting return or sending the message clearly signals the end of the sentence or thought. As a result, the period has come to be considered formal, a sign, according to my daughter and her friends, as well as linguists who study texting, that the writer is displeased and even angry. The exclamation point is the new period, one with a built-in warmth. When texting, "I'm coming home," is a simple statement of fact. "I'm coming home" means that you told your daughter to leave her friend's house and she's not happy about it. "I'm coming home," 1 exclamation point, is the default polite way to convey that you are looking forward to it, or at least not upset. "I'm coming home," 3 exclamation points, shows actual excitement. Well, this usage is spreading from texting to other informal kinds of writing. Hence, my email. I had to say, "See you soon," 1, to seem excited. It had to be, "Have a great time on your trip," 1. because this is now the polite form. And I had to write, it was so hot last week because it was hot, triple exclamation point. Thank you, Melissa Moore, for this modest lesson in grammar. Now we consider the United Kingdom fearing an apocalyptic Brexit. Supermarket shelves emptied, trucks backed up for miles at ports, airplanes grounded, diabetics short of insulin. These, said Tim Shipman and Mark Hookham in the London Sunday Times, are just a few of the calamities that could befall Britain if it crashes out of the European Union next March, without a trade and cooperation deal with the continent. Yet the government's preparations for such a no-deal Brexit scenario are both patchy and, in some regards, hair-raising. Health Minister Matt Hancock said his department was preparing to stockpile medicines, while Brexit Minister Dominic Raab said the government was working to make sure that there are adequate food supplies. But many foods and medicines will spoil if stored too long, and the country simply doesn't have enough warehouse space to stockpile large quantities of non-perishable goods. And how to refrigerate all that stuff if energy supplies are disrupted? The possibilities are so terrifying that the government has asked companies involved in Brexit planning to sign non-disclosure agreements in an attempt to prevent alarming details from leaking out. Well, let's look at just one aspect, the food industry, said Ian Dunt in politics.com.uk. The UK imports 40% of its food, with about 10,000 shipping containers arriving daily from the European Union. If the UK quit the EU's barrier-less customs union without a deal, all food going in and out of the UK will need to be checked at the border, causing catastrophic delays. Studies show that if the current average paperwork clearance of 2 minutes at Dover is increased to just 4, there would be a 20-mile backup within 24 hours. Now, extrapolate that mess to every other industry where just-in-time supply chains would be devastated by tariffs and customs checks. Whatever happened to the wartime spirit of keep calm and carry on? Asked Quentin Letts in the London Daily Mail. Leaders have become hysterics, predicting the imminent end of the world as we know it. Brexit will starve and isolate, they warn. It's like the doom-mongering that surrounded Y2K, when experts said a global software bug would cause computers to go haywire and planes to plummet from the sky when the year changed from 1999 to 2000. It didn't happen. If there is a no-deal Brexit, life will just toddle along pretty much as before. Well, that's one view. Only a small minority of hardline Europhobes in the ruling Conservative Party want a no-deal exit, said Vernon Bogdanor in the Guardian newspaper. Yet the UK might get one, because there is no sure majority in Parliament for any of the various forms of Brexit that can be offered. Conservative lawmakers won't back a deal that keeps the UK too close to the EU, or one that severs ties completely. And Prime Minister Theresa May's wishy-washy part-in and part-out Brexit plan pleases no one. The only solution is to hold another referendum and ask voters if they really, really want to leave the EU. The people must be asked to resolve the dilemma which Parliament cannot. Stay tuned and we'll find out. Climate change, the summer of hell. There's no way to sugarcoat it, said Tanya Basu in thedailybeast.com. Climate change is here, and we are living in its burning embers. The heat wave that gripped the planet in June and July was like nothing we've ever seen before. Deadly wildfires ravaged the western U.S., while weather stations in southern states registered 23 all-time highs. Records also tumbled across Europe, which was baked brown by sun and drought, with wildfires even breaking out above the Arctic Circle in Norway. The highest ever verified temperature in Africa was recorded in Algeria, 124.3 degrees Fahrenheit. And in Oman, scientists were stunned by a temperature of 109 at night, the hottest daily low ever recorded on Earth. The heat is front page news around the world, said Adam Corner in the New York Times. But it's striking how few people are concerned about climate change. The planet is literally catching fire before our eyes, validating decades of predictions from our scientists. Why is there no sense of alarm and urgency? Well, from the Investor's Business Daily comes this comment to that question. What do you expect? Al Gore and the other alarmists have indeed been droning on about climate change for decades, with dire scenarios on global collapse. Eventually, people stop paying attention. You can only predict the end of the world so many times. After all, people start to get skeptical. One hot summer notwithstanding, we are not doomed, said David French in the NationalReview.com. If you lived through the 1970s, you remember a time when rivers caught fire and cities were wreathed in dark clouds of smog. Through innovation and prosperity, we've largely now solved those environmental problems. And with a few more changes, more nuclear power, anyone? Even the alarmists will be forced to admit that doomsday will never come. Well, that's one view. Catastrophic change has already begun, according to Joel Achenbach in the WashingtonPost.com. And it's not just heat. The same climate models that predicted today's scorching temperatures also predicted that extreme weather events, such as heat waves, droughts, hurricanes, and floods would become more common, more intense, and longer lasting. Theory met reality. Let's not forget the historic 2017 hurricane season, which yielded three Category 4 or 5 hurricanes that flattened much of the Caribbean, nearly destroyed Puerto Rico, and submerged Houston. Scientists can't say with absolute certainty that the scorchers this summer are climate change's fault, but they have determined that climate change has more than doubled the probability of intense heat waves occurring. There are also the consistent, undeniable trends that show the planet getting hotter at a blistering rate. The last 4 years have been the hottest the world has ever experienced, which will undoubtedly have real and dire consequences. But how dire and how soon? Asked Kate Marvel in ScientificAmerican.com. Temperatures are rising staggeringly fast on geological timescales, but the rate of change is still relatively slow in comparison to a human lifetime. Unfortunately, that makes us unlikely to view it as a serious threat worth addressing. This summer should melt that complacency, said David Wallace Wells in the NewYorkMagazine.com. We are just beginning to see the horrors that climate change has in store for us. If the scientists are right, and so far their predictions have been largely on target, some parts of the planet will become uninhabitable by century's end, and oppressive heat could cause global economic output to fall by 30% or more. Whether or not we choose to face it, or even to talk about it, the transformation of the planet may be the biggest and the most important story of our time. The summer of hell and the comments about Brexit are both from the magazine The Week. Now to garbage. A garbage truck's worth of plastic enters the world's oceans every minute. All told, humanity has dumped up to 14 million tons of plastic pollution into the seas, and bits of it can be found from the water surface down to its most extreme depths. You wouldn't know it looking over the side of a ship, since much of the waste has been broken down by waves and by ultraviolet light into microplastics, particles often as small as a millimeter wide. But when researchers in 2015 analyzed more than a million pieces of trash in the Pacific garbage dump, 99.9% of it was plastic. Scientists have no idea how long it will take to degrade, perhaps hundreds of years, if ever. By 2050, according to the World Economic Forum, there will be more plastic by weight in the ocean than fish. And this is from The Week. Now, into the forest, where we find the whispering trees. Do trees talk with each other? Do they have feelings or memories? A controversial German forester says yes, and his ideas are shaking up the scientific world. In a provocative new book entitled The Hidden Life of Trees, What They Feel and How They Communicate, Peter Wohlleben, a German forester and author, has a rare understanding of the inner life of trees and is able to describe it in accessible, evocative language. At the age of 53, he has become an unlikely publishing sensation. He has sold more than 800,000 copies of his book in Germany and has now hit the bestseller list in 11 other countries, including the United States and Canada. A revolution has been taking place in the scientific understanding of trees, and Wohlleben is the first writer to convey its amazements to a general audience. The latest scientific studies conducted at well-respected universities in Germany and around the world confirm what he has long suspected from close observation. Trees are far more alert, social, sophisticated, and even intelligent than we thought. Since Darwin, we have generally thought of trees as striving, disconnected loners, competing for water, for nutrients, and sunlight, with the winners which shade out the losers, sucking them dry. The timber industry in particular sees forests as wood-producing systems and battlegrounds for survival of the fittest. Yet there is now a substantial body of scientific evidence that refutes that idea. It shows instead that trees of the same species are communal and will often form alliances with trees of other species. Forest trees have evolved to live in cooperative, interdependent relationships maintained by communication and a collective intelligence similar to an insect colony. These soaring columns of living wood draw the eye upward to their outspreading crowns, but the real action is taking place underground, just a few inches below our feet. Some are calling it the Wood Wide Web, according to Wohlleben. All the trees are connected to each other through underground fungal networks. Trees share water and nutrients through the networks and also use them to communicate. They send distress signals about drought and disease or insect attacks, and other trees alter their behavior when they receive these messages. And with that introduction to the whispering trees, we will continue in another program because our time today is getting shorter. And I wanted to tell you about my guests who will be on the next program. Link Smelser and Mr. Jerry Czar, Dr. Czar, will be visiting from the Kishwaukee Symphony Orchestra. Mr. Smeltzer is the music director and the conductor of the Kishwaukee Symphony Orchestra, which is celebrating its 42nd year this year. He will be in the studio. Dr. Czar will be here as a former player in the orchestra, a former horn player, who is now the historian of the orchestra. So I ask you to tune in for our next program. I think you will enjoy it immensely because we will be talking about this year's symphony selections and play some of those selections possibly on the program. So thank you for listening. Goodbye for now. A little of this and a little of that.